to pretty much sneak up on everyone and anything. I mean, sometimes you catch people just getting dressed and getting undressed, and you may catch people getting out of the shower, or you may even catch people making love.
Oh, I'd love to see the look on their faces.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us, babes. Today, why politics can be so divisive and what we can do about it. The latest rage in diets. It's not fast, but it's all about the fast. Why are conversations about money so hard and yet so important? We'll learn how to avoid financial landmines. And sex therapy. Is an erotic communication weekend in your future? Plus, shoot the breeze with the babes, keeping those skyscrapers gleaming. Hope you're not afraid of heights. These days, no matter if you're a liberal or a conservative, there seems to be no persuading the other side. Or is there? Jonathan Haidt is a professor of ethical leadership at the NYU Stern School of Business and author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided. He joins us on the phone from New York City to explore whether we can once again talk politics without breaking into a food fight. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you, Barb. Thank you, Kathy.
Well, I sound like my parents, but I really don't remember a time when our country has been so polarized. I mean, it seems like politicians hate each other, and you can't even talk with friends without it becoming downright hostile. So is politics at an all-time partisan high, or has it always been this way?
Well, it does vary. There was a little thing in the 19th century called the Civil War, and before then, during that, and after that, the country was pretty divided. There was even some violence on the floor of the Senate. The thing people have to realize is that the mid-20th century, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and into the 60s, was actually the unusual period because that's when polarization was the lowest it's been in our history. And things have gotten a lot worse since the 60s.
Well, why are we so polarized these days? And we don't even try to understand or respect the other side. So what's happened?
Gosh, there's so many things happening. It's a complicated story, but I'll just tell you two or three of the simplest and clearest ones. One, maybe the most interesting one for the listeners of your show, is the change of generations. And that is, there's some research showing that if your country is at war when you're a kid or a teenager, you grow up to be more cooperative, you work together, you're more patriotic. That's if there's an external enemy. So the greatest generation, your generation's parents, survived the Great Depression, the war, and in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, all the leadership were veterans or people who'd gone through that. And they were very good at setting aside their differences when necessary to work for the good of the country. When the boomers came along, what was their young adulthood? It wasn't fighting the ultimate evil foreign adversary. I mean, the Cold War was going on. But the moral challenges you guys faced were civil rights, the environment, feminism, all kinds of moral issues that set you guys at each other's throats because there were liberals and there were conservatives. There was a left and a right. And so the boomer generation was different from the greatest generation in so many ways. But one of them is that their moralism was directed more at internal divisions than at external conflict.
So it's all our fault, huh?
No, well, it's part of the causal story, but it's not as though you guys were bad people. It's that the moral challenge, you didn't have the luxury of having Hitler over there in Berlin to unify the whole country in perfect moral uniformity. You guys had the challenge of African Americans who had no civil rights, women who, had the vote, but not a lot more.
Right. In the Vietnam War.
You fought the battles as you saw them.
But don't you think we did pull together after 9/11?
For a few months we did. And this is something that I do blame George Bush for. I do think that both Bush and Obama had chances to unify the country and they failed. So after 9/11, Bush, as we know now, Bush used that as an excuse to push the agenda that he wanted to, which was to invade Iraq. So he blew a chance to really bring us together. Obama, after the fiscal crisis, after the collapse in 2008, he too could have done much more to bring the country together. Now he did, and in both cases, what I really mean is they could have called for sacrifice, and they never did. Neither one of them called for sacrifice. That's the sort of thing that brings the country together, shared sacrifice.
Which is what they did in World War II.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. But, my parents were kids during World War II. They remember collecting scraps of aluminum foil for the recycling effort.
Well, is the internet also to blame for this? Because, I mean, after all, people look at these crazy websites, and the only thing it really does is reinforce their own views.
Or the incessant Facebook postings, which really drives me crazy.
Exactly. Because so I'm a social psychologist, and my early research was on moral reasoning. And the big finding, not just from me, but from many people studying reasoning, is that we use it as a tool to confirm whatever we already believe or want to believe. We're just terrible at seeking out information that disconfirms our favorite beliefs, but we love to confirm them. And the internet has made that so easy. Just type your belief, whatever it is you want to believe, just type it in. You'll find some website that supports it.
Exactly. And just keep spreading that misinformation.
Yes. That's right. It's very difficult to call it back. That's right.
Well, you also suggest that people are really fundamentally intuitive, but not rational. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that our brains are products of evolution, just like all animal brains, and they're actually very similar to other animal brains, which means they solve problems by pattern matching. Our brains are very good at pattern matching. You come to see certain situations as being like something else, and you just know what to do. Now, we also developed language within the last million years, and we're able to do reasoning, but we're not that good at it. What tends to happen is our reasoning tends to get invoked after we've made up our mind. So if you see a painting and someone says, you know, do you like that? You say, well, yeah, I do. And they say, well, why do you like it? You really don't know why you like it, but you can make something up. You'll come up with an answer. And it's the same with our moral reasoning. Oh, well, you're in favor of gay marriage. Why is that? Well, you know, you can come up with a good answer, but most of it is intuitive based on your experiences, what team you're on, who your friends are.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour, and we're talking about why good people are divided by politics and if there's anything we can do about it. Our guest is Jonathan Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind. So, Jonathan, you were saying that we should appeal to people's intuition, not really their rationality. So are you basically saying that we should appeal to their emotions rather than trying to reason with them?
Well, what I'm saying is appeal to intuitions and emotions first. So the metaphor that I use from my last book, The Happiness Hypothesis, is that the mind is divided into parts like a rider on an elephant. The rider is our conscious reasoning. The elephant is the other 99%. It's all the automatic, intuitive, and emotional stuff. And I ask your listeners, how often have you changed somebody's mind by arguing with them? Probably not all that often. But if you start by appealing to intuition, if you start by acknowledging what your opponent is right about, if you're arguing about politics, suppose you're a liberal arguing with a conservative about gay marriage, you might say, you know, you conservatives have been saying that marriage is important for decades and that kids are better off when they have committed parents. And, you know, liberals often didn't listen to that. They wanted to validate every possible arrangement. But, you know, you guys were right. Okay, so if you start off with that and you acknowledge, you know what, family and stability and two people being legally committed is important, well, then you have some basis for saying, well, let's look at the 5% of the people are gay. They are having kids. How do you want those kids raised? So what I'm saying is not don't reason. We do need to give each other reasons in our political lives and in our democracy. But it's naive to think that we could just throw reasons at each other and expect the other person to change their mind. That's not going to happen.
Well, can you give us an example from the last presidential election where they actually tried to employ this technique that you're talking about?
Oh, my goodness. They're getting very sophisticated. Some of them actually read my book, The Righteous Mind. But the techniques go back decades, long before I was born, of using emotion, certainly using emotion first. Let's look at some of the big ones. So actually, both sides used them to deceive. Let's take there was a Romney ad how Obama wanted to end the work requirement for welfare. And they said, you know, they just give you your check. And it was, I think possibly a veiled racist argument. But what they're playing on is the long fear that conservatives have that liberals really just want to funnel money to poor people and black people and immigrants without work. Clinton ended the welfare policy in the 90s of just unlimited welfare. And Obama made a slight change requested by the governors. It was not at all ending the work requirement. But the Republicans made it into a commercial. They had vivid imagery, and they played on fears so that their lie, basically, was believable. Obama did a, it wasn't quite as bad, but one of his more misleading ads was about how Mitt Romney shut down a factory. You see this guy, his wife died of cancer because Mitt Romney, Bain Capital leveraged it and they lost their health insurance. That was not quite true. Romney actually, the woman got cancer much later, or I can't remember what the deal was. But the point is, liberals tend to focus on compassion more than conservatives. So if you start by appealing to people's compassion, oh my God, this poor woman, she has cancer, and now her health insurance, if you trigger compassion, then people will believe anything about the evil, the evil monster who killed her.
Right, but don't you think those ads can backfire? Because all those did is make me really mad when I watched them.
Well, the research, they could backfire, that's true, but I think you're unusual if both of them made you mad. Most people found that one of them made them mad, and the other one, or rather, one of them made them mad at the candidate who aired it, and the other one made them mad at the other candidate.
That's probably true.
Yeah. These guys know what they're doing. The political consultants get more and more sophisticated every 4 years.
So what is the best tool to really go about changing someone's mind?
The most powerful tool there is relationships. This is the problem in Congress. Congress, like all politics, these guys and women are incredibly socially skilled, and politics is in part the art of backslapping and cajoling and getting drunk together and doing all those things that politicians have always done. And in the 90s, that all ended. When Newt Gingrich came in, he changed the nature of Congress, encouraged new members to not live in Washington, but just commute in 2 or 3 days a week. So one of the biggest problems we face as a nation is that our political class doesn't have relationships anymore. And this is one of Obama's weaknesses, I think, is that he's not a good relationship builder. Clinton, Reagan, Johnson, they were all great relationship builders, and they could be effective for those reasons. In our personal lives, not at the political level, but in our personal lives, there's not much point in arguing with people that you don't have a relationship with. But if you share a meal with someone, if you are gentle with them and acknowledge things they're right about, then I think you can both try to persuade them and also you can learn from them.
Well, real quickly, Jonathan, in the real world, do you think there's any reason for hope that the sort of my way or the highway approach will change anytime soon?
I think there are two reasons for hope. One is that the Republican Party has gotten much more extreme in recent years. I try to be bipartisan, and I have a lot of respect for conservative ideas, but I do think that the Republican Party has gone off the deep end a bit, and they lost big, and they realized they lost big. And so I think that there will be some moderate elements in the Republican Party which will bring them back to the point where both parties are then more or less symmetrically crazy and extreme. That's one reason for hope.
Yes, they're both crazy.
But it's very encouraging. Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind. This really explains a lot. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
My pleasure, Barb, Abby.
Up next, what the drug companies won't tell us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Barbara, I don't know about you, but I hate the thought of dieting. Just the mere words make me want to eat.
I know exactly what you mean. And every other week, there's a new way to lose the pounds. It's no meat, all meat, veggies, water, lots of water, no carbs, and the worst, no Snickers bars. It's all so depressing.
But the latest diet these days, it's all about fasting. Just 2 days a week, and voila, we'll be in our bikinis in no time.
Not sure about that one, Kathy. Dr. Michael Mosley is a British physician who developed the two-day-a-week fasting regime. He says it not only spurs weight loss, but it can also reduce the risk of disease. His new book, The Fast Diet, is an international bestseller. Dr. Mosley joins us from London. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So how does this fasting diet work, or what you call the 5-2 diet?
What you do is you eat normally 5 days a week, so you're not thinking about dieting for 5 days a week, and then 2 days you cut your calories down to a quarter of the normal amount, which is about 600 calories for a bloke like me and about 500 calories for a woman. And that is really it. I mean, there's quite a lot of science behind it, but in essence, it's really simple. It's a different way of losing weight.
So if we stick to it, how long before we see results? Because after all, we don't have a lot of time to waste. Bathing suit season is right around the corner.
Yeah, we Absolutely. Want your fast diet to work fast.
If you want it to work really fast, then what you should do is alternate day fasting, which is basically you eat what you want one day and then you cut down to 500 calories the next day.
I have to tell you that my husband started your diet a few weeks ago and the pounds are like falling off of him. It's unbelievable.
Brilliant. Really pleased to hear that.
I want to ask you about the fasting itself. How many hours are you actually really talking about?
But what I do is I have breakfast with my family, and that's normally a couple of scrambled eggs and some ham or some smoked salmon or something if I'm feeling exotic. And then I drink lots of black tea, coffee, water, whatever throughout the day. And then I eat in the evening, which is about 7 o'clock with my family, and I eat a big pile of vegetables and some meat. There's some recipes in the Fast Diet book, and I find that works best for me, going for sort of effectively about 11 hours without eating, which is equivalent really of going overnight without eating, which we most of us do every day. Some people find that a bit tough, and they kind of need a bit of a snack in the middle of the day, and that's okay as well. But that's my regime.
Well, doctor, you say we can eat normally the other 5 days, but what if our normal is like cookies and cakes and brownies and Snickers bars? Can we still lose the weight if we fast the other 2 days?
You can, as long as you don't eat more than you normally would. I mean, clearly it would be desirable if you were also to cut back on those things. But I think the biggest problem with being on a diet is the feeling I'm permanently on the diet denying myself stuff. And if I'm thinking, oh, I want that Snickers bar, then all you can think about the Snickers bar, and at some point your willpower is going to cave in and you're going to eat loads of Snickers bars. So what I suggest on this is, as I said, you eat normally. You don't go and stuff your face full of Snickers ice cream or something like that. You just, if you sometimes go out for a pizza, go out for a pizza. If you sometimes go out for fish and chips, have fish and chips. But 2 days a week, you do cut down to a quarter. And what I've found is my taste preferences have changed over time. So that actually, because I'm eating a lot more sort of healthy vegetables and things like that on my fasting days, because they're the sort of things that really make you full, because they're full of bulk. I mean, you can get an awful lot of vegetables for the same calories as a Snickers bar. And because I'm doing that, and because I'm trying different recipes and things like that, then that's actually changed what I eat on my normal days, although I haven't made a deeply conscious effort to do so. But my wife, who's a doctor, she's kind of thrilled by this. So I've lost about 20 pounds of fat, and I found it quite easy to keep off.
Wow. So you are saying that we should moderate our diet on the normal days.
I wouldn't obsess about it, but it's better if you can, because obviously we all kind of know what a healthy regime looks like. But what I don't want people to do is obsess too much on the 5 days, because if they do, they'll just kind of break down.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Mosley. He's the author of The Fast Diet, Lose Weight, Stay Healthy, and Live Longer with the Simple Secret of Intermittent Fasting. Let's talk about how your diet compares to some of the other diets, like, you know, Atkins we know you don't like, and or weight.
I'm actually not that, you know, dismissive of Atkins, because an awful lot of things that Atkins claimed turned out to be true. So he said, for example, that protein is more satiating than carbs or fat, and he was absolutely right. In fact, I suggest that on the 2 days when you're, you know, cutting your calories, you should eat quite a lot of protein, because that will feel make you feel fuller and more satisfied. Long term, it's quite difficult to stay on Atkins, but I think he's coming round to a bit of a sort of, you know, recognition that he was a bit of a prophet in some ways.
Well, what about a diet like Weight Watchers?
I think Weight Watchers is better than most, but it's not very impressive. They did a big trial here in the UK. Some people went to see the doctor for advice. Some of them went to the pharmacist. Some went to Weight Watchers. They tried all sorts of things, and at the end of 2 years, the only group who had lost any weight were the group on Weight Watchers, and they hadn't lost much.
Can a fasting diet help retard breast cancer, for example, or dementia?
Anywhere where you lose about 5% of your body weight will cut your breast cancer risk quite dramatically by about 40%. But if you can also cut your insulin production or make yourself more insulin sensitive, which is what intermittent fasting seems to do, then that will cut your breast cancer risk. I mean, a lot of the research in the UK has been done particularly by a unit who are dedicated to studying breast cancer. And that's their passion and the reason why they got into intermittent fasting in the first place. And then they discovered actually it's a very effective way of losing weight.
I've heard that you should drink at least 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of water a day. Do you adhere to that on your diet?
I don't count my water, but I just do glug it down, particularly on fasting days, because otherwise there's the danger of headaches and constipation.
What about coffee? Do you like coffee on this
diet? I love coffee. Black coffee, fine. I mean, the trouble is it's the milk and the sugar which is the undoing of coffee.
What about artificial sweeteners?
I'm not crazy about artificial sweeteners, but I wouldn't say no to them.
Well, Dr. Michael Mosley, author of The Fast Diet, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Absolute pleasure.
As a follow-on to our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, we'd like to let our listeners know about a new app developed by the University of Illinois at Chicago about dementia. The Dementia Guide mobile app has screening questions, resources, and management tips, which can provide invaluable information for caregivers and loved ones of persons with dementia.
The developers are looking for non-professionals to test the Dementia Guide mobile app and provide feedback. If interested in participating, please contact Dr. Valerie Gruss at 312-413-9000 or email vgruss, that's V-G-R-U-S-S, at uic.edu.
When is the last time you talked about finances with your spouse, partner, child, sibling, or parent? Do you find it easier to talk about sex, even if it is a lot more fun, than money? While our convos around the dinner table may be a lively banter of outrageous topics, some of us may find it difficult to talk about our financial situation and how we'll make financial transitions through life, especially as we age.
Our next guest contends that the lack of communication about money can mean the difference between leaving heirs cared for and comfy or embroiled in sibling brawls, destroying family relationships and finances. But it doesn't have to be that way, says Lori Sackler. Lori is a senior vice president at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management and joins us on the phone from New Jersey. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being on the show. And it sounds like you guys could have written my book. I love the way you describe it.
Oh, well, we're tickled. Now, we know we should do it, obviously, have that conversation. But why is it so important to have a plan?
Research supports the notion that you have to have a plan and then you have to talk about it. So there's a staggering 70% failure rate in transferring wealth across generations. And further research shows that breakdown in communication and trust is at the heart of these failed transfers. And all of this is happening at a time when there's about $59 trillion passing across generations in the next 50 years. So it's important.
Wow.
You know, we need to have the plan. We need to talk about it.
Now, let's talk about the talk. Who should be involved when we have that convo about our finances?
That's a really good question. So I discuss in the M word how to successfully engage in that conversation, and there's a lot of planning and preparation that goes into it. So it's like answering the who, what, when, where, and how. So who's a big part of it? You have to figure out, you know, what you want to accomplish. Who are the players that need to be involved in this? What are the issues at play? And so it's going to depend on the circumstances. So if it's dealing with an issue of trying to get your parents possibly to talk to you about what they're going to leave you in the will or what role you're going to play, then obviously you're going to be included in that conversation with them. But I recommend you have advisors to help you do it because it's so tough to do this on your own. And it's a pretty difficult conversation and difficult topic, a taboo topic to have a conversation around. So, yeah, you need to think through who are the right people, and I recommend you get people involved who may not be a professional advisor, but who's someone that can get the ear of the person that needs to listen, then that person should be included.
Well, Lori, what about boomers who are remarrying or finding a new partner? You know, they're merging families. How do they navigate what could be a financial landmine?
It's all about merging finances and families. So what I discuss and I recommend is you have these conversations early on. And it's going to make that plan so much easier because, yes, you're going to have to discuss whether or not you're going to keep assets separate or you're going to merge some. You can talk about how you're going to handle the kids. You know, what are the roles and obligations of everybody in the family? So it's a big conversation. And once again, careful thinking through what are the issues and getting the right players in the room. And I introduce a set of tools, what I think are guidelines to help people have these productive conversations.
And then, of course, another big issue facing boomers is caring for elderly parents, which, as we know, and I'm walking the walk and living the moment, is, you know, it's enormously expensive, and it could be up to $100,000 a year, and if not more in some cases. But how does somebody possibly prepare for the cost and sustain it?
Yeah, you know, the boomers, which is what your conversation is about weekly on the show, are the sandwich generation. So I'm dealing with a 91-year-old mother-in-law who we're caring for. At the same time, I have a son in college, so it's expensive. And yeah, so what you do is you really have to put together a plan, and the plan is going to be based on the physical as well as the financial care for this person. And it's figuring out what are the costs involved, and of course, getting the right team together to figure out what's the best care plan and financial plan to cover it. I mean, it's not going to be the same for every family. So if someone has long-term care insurance, that's going to be a really good vehicle to use. But, you know, you've got to compare what the resources are to what the costs are going to be.
Right. Well, Lori Sackler, we'll just have to have you back.
Oh, that sounds fun. Are we done?
We're done. Unfortunately, Lori Sackler, financial planner and author of The M Word, thanks so much for sharing this great info with the Two Boomer Babes.
Oh, it's delightful to be on the show. And for further information, you can go to themword.com.
Up next, sex therapy. What is it and who can benefit? Stay with us. If you've seen the movie Hope Springs Eternal, you'll remember the scene in which Meryl Streep played the frustrated boomer who dragged a reluctant husband to sex therapy. They'd been married for decades, and their relationship had become downright boring and devoid of passion. Both felt stuck and didn't know how to get their mojo back. It's a movie, yes, but the situation is not uncommon for many boomers.
But what exactly is sex therapy, and how is it helpful, and who's most likely to benefit? Joining us on the phone from North Carolina is Lori Watson, a certified sex therapist and author of Wanting Sex Again, How to Discover Your Desire and Heal a Sexless Marriage. Welcome back to the show, Lori.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What exactly is sex therapy? I mean, I sort of conjures up these images in my mind, at least, of like throw pillows and candles and maybe Barry White playing softly in the background.
Dr. Joyce Brothers.
Right. No, sex therapy really is just talk therapy. And I think the movie was very targeted to exactly what I do. I mean, many times couples come in and they sit on my couch. People ask me, what does your room look like? And it looks just like a living room. I mean, there's lamps and couches and chairs, and that's it. And, you know, we just sit and talk about something that most people don't talk about very openly. That's all it is.
Do you have coffee and Wi-Fi?
I have Wi-Fi, no coffee.
Oh, okay.
They eat breakfast at home, Kathy.
Diet Coke if they really want it.
Now, what kinds of problems do you address as a sex therapist?
I deal with many issues, and I kind of consider them on different tiers. And so the first set of problems that I would deal with would be a lack of orgasm, or maybe a menopausal woman who is just getting used to the different changes that her body's going through, or a man who has premature ejaculation or erectile dysfunction. Those are kind of top-tier issues.
And do sometimes people come to you individually and then bring their partner, or do they always bring their partner?
No, oftentimes people begin the process just by themselves. Sometimes they, you know, want to talk about something without their partner there, or they just feel like it would be better for them to get things off their chest first by themselves. And that's fine. You know, I'll start with people any way they want. Sometimes it becomes obvious that the bringing the partner in is really helpful.
So how do you lure in the partner?
That's a good question. And luring in the partner really, sometimes I say, you know what, tell your spouse or your partner that I just need their help for a little bit so that I can get their perspective on what the problem is. So I'm usually the hook. You know, I'll have them come in for a session alone, especially if I've been seeing their partner alone, and then I'll have them talk to me about what's going on. And oftentimes I'll be able to kind of help them see how working at it together really would be more efficient. And I think people are anxious that I'll take sides and I won't be able to see their perspective. And once they see that I can kind of hold two perspectives at once, then they're more likely to come in.
But I would imagine it would be really difficult to open up to a spouse about sexual issues, not to mention a third party in a therapy session. So how do you get people to feel comfortable enough to do that?
You know, I just do not have very much trouble getting people to talk about sex. I think people in our culture don't talk about it. We see the movies, we see the media portraying that everybody has such easy sex, right? But people don't have easy sex. And I think it's such relief to have somebody say that to them, that they're like, oh, yes, you're not kidding. And these are my problems. And so they just kind of come in and spill. And with a spouse, sometimes doing it separately helps. I think we are anxious about talking about things in front of our partner if we're going to hurt them or make things worse or we'll get in a fight with them. But I'm there to mediate. And oftentimes, just the way I talk about it makes it go so much smoother.
Well, Lori, what actually happens during a session? You just kind of start the ball rolling, so to speak?
Right. So what I like is by the time somebody works up the courage to come see a sex therapist, these things have been building up inside for a long time. And maybe they've told their gynecologist or they've told their doctor. They said, you know, that this is the problem and who do I go see? And they come in. And I basically want them to tell me what's hurting them. I often do background work, but that's on paper. And then the first session, I'll have them just, you know, tell me how they met, and we chat a little bit. And then I'll say, you know, what's going on? Tell me why you're here. And they'll open up, and they'll say, oh, you know, gee, I'm in menopause, and all the things that used to work don't work anymore. And, you know, my lubrication is not as easy as it used to be. Or they'll say, you know, my partner and I, you know, we've gotten to a new stage in a relationship. And that was what I was going to say. A second tier of problems really are relational issues. Sex is so entangled in the relationship that many times what I end up doing is helping people straighten out the relationship as well. But we do it from an angle about sex.
Now, do you see lots of boomers, I would assume, that have been in long-term relationships and maybe need to, you know, are having a few sexual issues?
Oh, yes. Lots. Mm-hmm. Lots. And people who are starting over, mm-hmm. you know, maybe divorced or widowed or need, you know, a look at what is dating like now that I'm coming back into it again. How has it changed since I was 20? What do I need? And I would say, number one thing, be careful. There's STDs out there. You know, use protection. That's my number one message. But they talk about all the different ways that his issues and her issues are kind of intersecting. You know, for instance, maybe he has ED now. And she's so used to it being so easy and natural for him. That was how she relied on knowing that he was attracted to her. So suddenly, as she's aging, she's thinking, oh, gosh, you know, I'm changing, my body is changing, I'm not as young as I used to be, and suddenly he has this problem, does this mean he's not as attracted to me? And he's looking at her thinking, you know, she's drier, that was the way I used to know, she was really ready for sex and really wanted me, so maybe she doesn't want me, and couples often stop what was an old pattern of natural initiation and seduction because they get the wrong signal from each other. It's not true at all. But like you said, they haven't been able to communicate about it. And so as they come in and start talking about it, then we sort all that out.
You're tuned in to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. Our guest is sex therapist Lori Watson. We're talking about sex therapy, what it is and isn't, and how it can help revive a tired relationship. Lori, how bad should it get before we actually consult an expert?
You know, I think that couples come too late. I mean, obviously, oftentimes I will, you know, give my cards to the doctors, and a person will tell me, oh, I've had your card in my purse for 3 years. And I think, oh, my goodness. And many times those problems would have been fixed in 6 weeks, and they waited 3 years to fix them. And you figure they waited another 2 years before they even told their doctor about it.
Well,
so it's really, it's something I think people don't see as sex therapies because it seems like such a scary thing, like you said. You know, is this going to be candlelight and pillows on the floor and I'm going to be asked to do something in front of this person? It seems really far out. But it's all talk therapy. There's no nudity, no exams, and no sexual touching in the room. That's all happens back in the couple's bedroom.
And just out of curiosity, how much does sex therapy cost? Or what's the range?
Yeah, I mean, the range would be probably from about $100 an hour to $200 plus.
And does insurance cover any of that?
Insurance covers, yes, a portion of our fee.
I know that you're located in North Carolina, but do you actually do phone consultations for any of our listeners anywhere that
yes,
might?
Yes, I do Skype therapy. And I have two colleagues who also do Skype therapy, and we do consulting over the phone. We can help couples anywhere in the nation. So, and they can see me on my website. LoriWatson.com is the easiest way to reach me. I also blog for Psychology Today. So if they really want to get a feel for who I am and, you know, what I teach and what I work with, that's another good place to see me. It's called Married and Still Doing It.
Ooh, love it. Well, Lori, in closing, I have to ask you about that erotic communication weekend that I saw on your website.
Yes,
that sounds
yes.
really intriguing. So tell us a bit about it.
Okay, well, this is a fun way. It's an economical way to come and see me. What couples do is maybe come for some luxurious retreat. Sometimes we do it in the mountains. Sometimes we do it at the beach. It depends. And this is really for healthy, functioning couples who just want to improve their sex life. And on Friday night, we do kind of a get-to-know-you. Nobody has to talk to anybody else, though. There's no question that they'll be asked that is of a personal nature. That all happens between the couple. But I do lecturettes, and then I give them assignments. And everybody has their own room, and they have time during the weekend to spend together to answer these questions. And couples who have gone through it say that, they have made such progress and become so much more intimate after the weekend. So it's really a fun thing to do. And right now we don't have one scheduled. I'm sorry. We're looking at March of 2014.
Well, you keep us posted, Lori, on the locale, okay?
Okay,
that's a long way off, and I'd love to take a glimpse of the homework assignments.
Oh, Kathy.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, some of what we do is actually talking. I'll give you a hint. One thing I do is I have a couple break down the sexual experience into four parts. So seduction and initiation, the actual arousal and touching, orgasm, and then afterglow. And I have them write very specifically by themselves kind of their optimal experience. What do they fantasize about? What would be the best way to be approached? How do they like to be touched? They write it all down, and then I have them go back to their bedrooms and sit with each other back to back and read alternately these what they've written down to each other. And sort of not looking at each other face-to-face sometimes gives them a little freedom. They're still connected by touch, and they're telling each other these things in what is really helpful, a positive, directive way.
Hmm. Well, maybe we'll have some homework assignments tonight, Kathy.
Well, sex therapist Lori Watson and author of Wanting Sex Again, this has certainly been enlightening, and you really make it sound like a lot of fun.
It is fun, yes.
Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we shoot the breeze with a man who keeps the Chicago skyline
gleaming.
Bailey
Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
As a follow-on to our series, Beyond the Face of Alzheimer's, we'd like to let our listeners know about a new app developed by the University of Illinois at Chicago about dementia. The Dementia Guide mobile app has screening questions, resources, and management tips, which can provide invaluable information for caregivers and loved ones of persons with dementia.
The developers are looking for non-professionals to test the Dementia Guide mobile app and provide feedback. If interested in participating, please contact Dr. Valerie Gruss at 312-413-9000 or email vgruss, that's V-G-R-U-S-S, at uic.edu.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
When you're a window washer of very tall buildings and your office is literally in the clouds, an ordinary day at work is not ordinary to most of us. We babes wondered what it's like to work under such conditions, so we went to the source.
Today, we're shooting the breeze with Phil Kajawa, a foreman at Corporate Cleaning Services in Chicago and window washer of skyscrapers for over 28 years. He joins us on the phone from the Windy City, which has its share of very tall buildings. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, first we have to ask, where are you calling from? We hope you're on terra firma and not like 90 floors up.
That's correct. I'm on a nice, calm surface right now.
Oh, good.
Well,
good.
Thank goodness.
We're relieved to hear that. Well, what's the tallest building you've ever worked on? The
tallest building I've ever worked on was Trump Tower.
And how many stories is that?
93 floors.
Oh, my knees are getting weak just thinking of it.
And you went all the way up to the 93rd?
That's correct.
Ooh.
That's correct.
So when you do this, is your rig tethered down or, you know, does it sway? What happens?
Well, there's a couple of different ways. I mean, sometimes you're just swinging in the breeze. I mean, they have what they call free swinging stages, and they have ones that are what they call house rigs. And the house rigs are basically connected to the building, but you still get some pretty hefty wind that's still a roll through there.
Well, especially coming over Lake Michigan, you know, in Chicago.
That's why it's the Windy City.
Exactly.
Correct.
Well, do you wear a parachute just in case?
No, you know what? We've often thought about that, but no, we don't have any parachutes. We just got our safety gear and that's it.
You don't have somebody holding a trampoline right below you just in case?
I wish that were the case, but no.
Wow. Well, Phil, you must get an eyeful by washing windows in high-rise apartment buildings. What was the most surprising thing you've ever seen?
Oh, my goodness. You pretty much sneak up on everyone and anything. I mean, sometimes you catch people just getting dressed and getting undressed, and you may catch people getting out of the shower, or you might even catch people making love.
Oh, I'd love to see the look on their faces.
Oh, my goodness. And it's funny because, you know, they'll see you and they'll forget that you have a partner and they'll run from the window that you're in to the next one. And now your partner gets an eyeful.
Oh, my gosh. Do you ever knock on the window or, like, ask for water or coffee or anything?
Well, actually, we get a lot of people that just come to us, and they'll actually open their window, and they'll give us some coffee. You get some people who actually try to give you liquor and alcohol, and they tell you, you sure you don't need something to drink?
Yeah, you might need it being all the way up there. Well, Phil, have you ever had any scares?
No, that's something that we're pretty much on top of that. I mean, you get one chance in this job, and that's it.
Well, what's the scariest part of your job?
The scariest part of my job is, I'd say, pretty much for me and any other window washer, is just getting over that first fear of getting over the side of a building.
So you actually go to the top of the building and wash from the top down?
That's correct.
Ooh.
See, so you have to climb over the edge and just kind of drop down?
You're just pretty much dangling there like a spider.
Oh, my gosh.
That's it.
Are you always on a rig, or are you ever, like, hanging, like you see Spider-Man going up and down the buildings?
No, we're pretty much, I mean, you got rigs and you got what we call rappelling, which is using ropes. And generally, that's what we do. 90% of our work is we're rappelling off of thin genie lines.
Well, I guess in your free time, you never want to go mountain climbing or anything, do you?
No, not really. I'm basically mountain climbing, parachuting every day of the week.
Exactly.
And I guess you're not afraid of heights, right?
No, not at all.
Have you ever been?
Honestly, it's been so long, I couldn't tell you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we applaud your job. We don't think we could ever do it, but we think it's wonderful you do.
Never.
Well, Master Window Washer Phil Kajawa, it's really been a pleasure. And you know what? Have no fear, because Kathy and I will never be going after your job. Thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the two Boomer Babes.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Everybody might not be able to say this, but our next guest turned to her husband, a chemist, and said, "Whip me up something to relieve my annoying itch." Mary Ambrose, president of Molecular Solutions, joins us in our studios to share her story. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Mary, so what happened that spurred you on to invent your own solution to your itch problem?
One mosquito bite too many.
Really?
Yes. After living in parts of the country that have incredible bugs, I never had the idea until in D.C., a mosquito bite just put me over the edge. And I turned to my husband and said, "Okay, I'm going to try the meat tenderizer trick that you put on jellyfish stings," which works kind of, but then it dries and it falls off, so it doesn't really work. And we talked about it, and I said, "Is there any reason that you can't put meat tenderizer in lotion and then it would stay on your bite long enough to do something?" And the first question is, what is a meat tenderizer? And we started looking at the bottle and playing around with it, and suddenly it started to make sense.
Did you ever just try hydrocortisone cream?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't
help
at all.
Huh.
No,
huh.
No, it doesn't help at all.
Yeah.
In fact, there was an article in the New York Times talking about itch. And it basically said cortisone creams and antihistamines, all of those things really do nothing for itch problems.
So when you started to develop this cream, what did you do? Sort of mix up batches in your kitchen?
Yes, exactly. Really? First, just with lotion off the shelf and ground up bromelain, which is what's in meat tenderizer, but you couldn't tell what you were actually getting. And if you've ever looked at a bottle of hand lotion, there are at least 25 ingredients in it, and you're thinking, well, that's not such a great idea. So then it was on to buying pure bromelain, which you can buy in powder form, then buying base lotion, which also has 25 ingredients in it. And the next thing was go to the kitchen and figure out how to make lotion.
That is amazing. And I have a hard time scrambling an egg. My gosh. Well, Mary, did you do actually some scientific trials? How do you know that it works?
We first tried it on me, obviously, the logical guinea pig, but we got it down to 7 ingredients plus distilled water. So the only things in it really are shea butter and grapeseed oil and the emulsifier. It's all plant-based. And we started sending it out to friends and family, of course, saying, would you try this and then fill out my little form and answer my questions? Send me the form back. Let me know. I guess I mailed out over a period of time probably 200 plus samples to people and to dogs because it works on dogs.
And we want to know that one. How did you even know that? It would work on a dog. Do you have a dog with an itch problem?
No, but we knew someone who did. And God love him, he took photos before and after of his dog's tummy. And she had this terrible problem. He said, we put it on, and for the first time, we could sleep through the night because the dog wasn't scratching all night.
So did you recruit other dogs for this experiment? Really?
Yes.
Oh, we have a few we could give you.
I'm taking dog volunteers all the time.
Mary, does it work on poison ivy?
It does.
Ooh.
It works on everything it's been tried on to date. I'm waiting for chigger season.
I was just going to say that because
chigger season's coming.
This last weekend, my husband roped me into raking leaves in the yard.
Oh, the nerve.
I know. And do you know what happened? I now have chiggers. So I hope you brought some samples, Mary.
I did indeed.
Good. So, Mary, what are your plans? Are you going to launch your product or what's going to happen next?
Kiss My Itch Goodbye is incorporated in D.C. and the trademark has already been approved by the trademark people.
Wow,
which
that's
was
a big deal.
I have now approval on a provisional patent. So that's taken care of. And the product's for sale on the web. And I am shipping it out every day.
Did you ever think that this might really be sort of your midlife reinvention?
Heavens no. And the challenge for me, having worked in sales pretty much all of my career, I have only sold high-end software, consulting, bodies, i.e. recruiting. I have never sold anything that sells for less than $25.
Oh,
it's a whole new world. I'm just really learning a lot.
Well, as you've sort of gone through this process, is there any advice you would offer someone else who has the next brilliant idea, you know, like you've just had, about how to really navigate the system and how to find a way to take your little product or your invention and get it to market?
I guess you really have to be willing to jump off a cliff because you have no idea if it will work if you don't try it.
Well, Mary Ambrose, inventor of Kiss My Itch Goodbye, best of luck on your launch in the product and much success to you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with both of you.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.